I'm sitting on the balcony reading Flannery O'Connor with a pencil and a pen.
So I think he's saying that all meaning works like that. There is no kind of head-on use of language that is literal and descriptive.
This song is like a rain cloud that keeps circling overhead. And there it comes around again.
Hi, Antonia.
Hi, Kate. Welcome back, everybody. We come to you today with a delightful selection of work. But who are we, Kate?
We are. That's a very, very metaphysical and profound question. But on a slightly less profound level, we are the presenters of Florilegium. Florilegium is our radio show for Radio Maria. And the name comes from a kind of text from the medieval era, which pieced together scraps of writing from usually things like the church fathers or ancient philosophers like Aristotle, or bits of text from all over the place, really. And it developed to include like information about herbs and what to do in your garden and all kinds of literature. And the more famous version of it is the commonplace book of the Victorian era. But the sort of Florilegium is the original. And we have called ourselves that because this podcast brings together scraps of things that may not have smooth connections between them, but it doesn't matter because that's the form. So we bring together literature, usually poetry, and little bits of gardening knowledge and reflections. And it's all wrapped up in a focus on the liturgy, or drawing inspiration from the liturgy, by which we really mean the text that is from the gospel or scriptures that is being reflected on at that point in the liturgical calendar. So that's really how liturgy enters. Occasionally we do actually discuss matters of liturgy as well, like whether you should have electric candles in the church.
Answer, no, definitely not.
The answer is no, officially no.
So today we're doing the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker. His feast day is the 1st of May. So hopefully you get to listen to this on or around that day. So we'll be doing the reading from John 15, 1 to 8. We're going to talk about Don Patterson's poem, Two Trees, which is about grafting. So we're going to also then talk about grafting as our gardening topic.
And when you say grafting, can you give a really brief description?
Yeah, well, you'll hear it in the poem, but grafting is where you splice one tree into another so that one grows from the other's roots.
Great. Let's read the gospel.
This is a reading from the Gospel of John. Jesus said to his disciples, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that bears no fruit, he cuts away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, to make it bear even more. You are pruned already by means of the word I have spoken to you. Make your home in me as I make mine in you. A branch cannot bear fruit all by itself, but must remain part of the vine. Neither can you unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever remains in me, with me in him, bears fruit in plenty. For cut off from me, you can do nothing. Anyone who does not remain in me is like a branch that has been thrown away. He withers. These branches are collected and thrown on the fire, and they are burnt. If you remain in me, and my words remain in you, you may ask what you will, and you shall get it. It is to the glory of my Father that you should bear much fruit, and then you will be my disciples.
Do you want to share an echo?
I think I was struck by the lines, make your home in me as I make mine in you. As a branch cannot bear fruit all by itself, but must remain part of the vine, neither can you unless you remain in me. I think that strikes me because it makes me think of the times where I wonder if I could do this on my own terms, you know, like maybe I don't need God in this, you know, maybe I don't need the church, maybe I can strike out, and just the experience of how that works out for me, usually withering and realizing, coming back with, just that knowledge of how much fruit can be born even from a small and puny branch if the branch is part of the vine, which is Christ.
Because I was thinking as well about the to use the metaphor of a vine and a vine dresser is also to use the gardening metaphor, which it involves things that hurt. That sense of like you grow, like the, we were thinking of reading the gospel today, which says, my yoke is easy. There's still a yoke there. It's not like, don't worry, you don't have to carry anything. There's no burden. It's like there is a burden. And I think that that's what really strikes me about this is that making your home in Christ does not mean, lying down in great comfort and not doing anything. It means being tended to as a gardener tends to fruit trees and vines. And that means being clipped and tucked. And I think I kind of constantly come back to this, and we've come back to it a few times in our discussions, but that the things that God asks of us are not things that you would choose to do without God. And so when I think we see people around us who don't have a knowledge of God in any deep sense, not doing those things, it sort of makes sense because it's like, well, why would you? Why would you be pruned and clipped and tucked? Why would you let that happen to you if you don't have the motivation of living in Christ? And seeing that as a profoundly like beautiful thing.
In Catechesis of the Good Shepherd, the main gospel for the 3 to 6 year olds is the parable of the Good Shepherd. I am the Good Shepherd. I know my sheep by name. I lay down my life for my sheep. And then for the 6 to 9 year olds, this, I am the true vine. I am the vine. You are the branches. Cut off from me, you can do nothing. That's the main gospel for the 6 to 9 year olds when the little ones are coming into understanding more about morality. But it's so interesting how it's not the first one that you go in with. Like the first is about building this relationship with the Good Shepherd, that he knows you by name and that he loves you. And they understand that so deeply and so profoundly. And so then when they're coming to Christ as the vine and them as the branches, they're coming to that with that understanding of being loved and being known. And so it's a completely different response that they have to it, because then obviously if you're loved and known, you want to do the right thing. Like you long to be pruned and to please the vine dresser, as it were, or to be part of this vine, which is really different from coming to it and seeing only the kind of moralistic God who wants to chop off all the bad things and even the good things, wants to, cut them back too. So I think it's also really good to read it in that light. And I think perhaps catechesis has got better since we were small, but it's I think that's revolutionary.
That's really beautiful and makes so much sense.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
Anyone's got children who are coming up to 3, find your nearest catechesis of the Good Shepherd and send them in.
Yeah, I'm gonna take that as an order.
Yeah, that was aimed at you, Kate.
Yeah. Lovely. Okay, so we've got a recording of Don Patterson reading Two Trees, which we're going to play for you now.
Two trees. One morning, Don Miguel got out of bed with one idea rooted in his head to graft his orange to his lemon tree. It took him the whole day to work them free, lay open their sides, and lash them tight. For 12 months, from the shame or from the fright, they put forth nothing, but one day there appeared two lights in the dark leaves. Over the years, the limbs would get themselves so tangled up, each bough looked like it gave a double crop. And not one kid in the village didn't know the magic tree in Miguel's patio. The man who bought the house had had no dream, so who can say what dark, malicious whim led him to take his axe and split the bowl along its fused seam, and then dig two holes? And no, they did not die from solitude, nor did their branches bear a sterile fruit, nor did their unhealed flanks weep every spring for those 4 yards that lost them everything, as each strained on its shackled root to face the other's empty, intricate embrace. They were trees, and trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about.
There you go. How did you like the way he read it?
Oh, he's such a grumpy geezer. It's like this really tender poem, and you're really swept up in it, and the emotion of these trees, and then he just slams it down, just looks at you and goes, "Yeah, that's all it's about." I don't know. How would you explain it?
Well, yeah, you're right. I feel like we need almost to hear the first line again to get the contrast. Because when you hear that poem for the first time, or any poem, it's quite difficult to like retain the first bit in your head,
Yes.
especially when there's an ending like that. But the first lines are, "One morning Don Miguel got out of bed with one idea rooted in his head to graft his orange to his lemon tree." And it's, and like Antonia says, it starts with this kind of magic. This experience that I think most people have had, where you wake up one morning and you know what your purpose is for that day. It's such a rare feeling. But that sense of an idea rooted in his head, he's just got to do this. This is his project. And in that first stanza, it also says, at the end of that stanza, "Not one kid in the village didn't know the magic tree in Miguel's patio." So it has that sense of magic about it, this project of having these two trees become one. So then, when you kind of can retain that sense of the excitement of this beauty and of this crafting and grafting together to make two things become one, to then get that line at the end, having heard the story of Don Miguel's dream being undone by the next man who comes to live in the house, who sort of tears these trees apart and plants them again as separate trees, and he gives all this emotive language about how.
Unhealed flanks weep every spring.
Yeah, so he gets you feeling this, the loss of it. And then he delivers those lines, as Antonia said, "Trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about," which makes it so devastating, especially when you've got a grumpy Scotsman looking into your eyes and saying it with a sense of apathy and despair. It's a poem that I love, this one.
What do you love about it?
Well, I suppose I've come to be able to love it because I've used it quite a lot in the classroom. And so one of the things I love about it is I love seeing people go deeper into it and discover that it's not what it is on the surface.
How do you mean?
So, like, as in, one of the features of Don Patterson's poetry is that he uses quite recognizable forms and meter and rhyme. So it sounds nice on the ear, and there is a kind of invitingness in that, and so people have a willingness to kind of want to understand it. Whereas a lot of, as you know, if I'm doing modern poems, for example, most of the time there's a sense of, oh God, this is like going to be an effort or something. It's obscure. I don't really get it. And then gradually people get it, and there is a satisfaction in that. Whereas this one, people like it to start with because they like because it's a story, and people like a story, and then they have the experience of going, okay, so hang on, there's something going on here that I don't understand. I do understand it, but there is something I don't understand, which is like, usually the last two lines. And then there's like a peeling back process, going, okay, well, what's going on that isn't being said on the surface? And then I feel like it's more accessible as a poem to do that with than a lot of other poems. So there's that one reason. But also, having taught it to lots of classes, I still feel like there's more I want to discover about it. I still there's a lot that I don't understand about it. So those are some reasons. I guess it's got both simplicity and complexity, and that always feels nice. There was something that I heard Don Patterson say about the poetry of his friend Michael Donaghy, who I'll mention at some point because he comes into the understanding of this poem, but that he said something like, "It's like he sings." His poetry kind of sings with lightness, but carries heaviness. So yeah, it's got both that sense of you can take it however far you want to go with it. Just like going to a concert, you can just listen to the music and just enjoy it, and have a kind of a little bit of a enjoy the abandon of listening to that creativity, or you can let it lead you down profounder roads about what's the purpose of my life and what am I doing.
That often happened to you at concerts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just feel like this is a poem about friendship. And that you just have that image of, people being, or two people being sort of thrown together, and maybe it's thrown together by circumstance or thrown together by a kind of coincidence, but that something then binds them in that friendship, and they grow through life together with it. And then that agony and brutality of that being split by something else, often, you know, by something arbitrary or by something maybe not arbitrary, you know, maybe an act of deliberate splitting, because, you know, someone or other thinks that your paths of life have diverged too much to be entwined as you are. That feels like it resonates with the man who buys the house, who has no dream, and on a whim split the bowl along its fused seam and then dug two holes. And there's such a that, you know, that split might be a death in itself, or it might just be a kind of a break of some thought, whether intentional or not. But then that thing of, well, then how does life carry on after it, you know, that it with the grief of that loss? And it does.
Yeah.
But the way then he describes it is them sort of not weeping for it and not straining for each other. That's interesting too, because in one way you could read it as, well, they obviously are. And in one, you can read it as knowing those kinds of friendships, or knowing a friendship where you have known how much it is to be completely one another's confidant, and then suddenly to not have that, and to just be like, okay, well, maybe in a pragmatic sense, well, you just don't, you know, and you carry on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Patterson has got that sense going on in it too, hasn't he? Because he's spliced together or grafted his name and his friend's name together.
Yeah. So you mean this the name Don Miguel?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So Don Patterson and then Michael Donaghy, Miguel. Yeah, they kind of graft together. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's quite nice. In a way, you kind of given a summary of like one way of reading the poem. But I guess the reason I'm saying like one way of reading it is because I feel like that you could read this poem and not come away with that at all. Like if you didn't know about Michael Donaghy, for example, then there's nothing in it to explicitly say this is about friends or friendship. I mean, it could be about romantic love, for example.
Well, when I first read it, I thought of marriage.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the reading, which is like, grow together like trees still bearing fruit when they're old, still full of sap, still green. One of the Psalms.
Mm.
And I thought of that and the sense to which marriage is a kind of grafting of yourself to another and a, you know, becoming one, a two tree to one thing. But then the second verse is just too bleak if you read it like that, because then you have the severing of it.
I was going to say, although in some sense, if you do read it with that romantic, like, you know, the idea that it is marriage, it's got that sense running through it, then when you get to those last lines, they were trees and trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about. There is a reading of it where you could say, okay, well, in a sense, that just highlights the difference between trees, what it is to be trees and what it is to be human.
Mm.
That actually, these are trees, so they don't have to suffer that.
Mm.
But the reason that we read it into them, that we kind of anthropomorphize them and think and have all this sympathy for them in the poem, is because we are like that. And so in a sense, those last lines, the harshness of that sort of cut of the last lines is actually, in some sense, affirmative, like affirming.
Okay, well, that's nice. That makes it a bit better.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think there is a way in which that you could read it like that.
Saying don't get too caught up in the emotions of it, or putting yourself in the position of these trees.
Yeah, or just using it as a, like, using the last two lines as a kind of, like, the equivalent I'm thinking of is like when the Zen master bangs the Zen student on the head with a bamboo stick.
Mm.
That kind of like wake up.
Mm.
It has the effect of going, think more deeply about what's happening as you read this poem. And I can kind of imagine Don Patterson doing that. I mean, also, I can imagine him being a sort of miserable sort of geezer about it as well, as you said. But the other thing I'd say is that there's this technique going on in the poem, which I've taught in debating classes, and like, because it's an old rhetorical device, which is called praetoritio.
What's that?
I'm probably mispronouncing it, to be honest with you. But anyway, it's when you say, you know, if I were kind of introducing you, Antonia, and I said, it wouldn't be fair to mention like Antonia's, you know, expulsion from school, because that will put her in a bad light. So I won't mention that, and I'll go on to talking, telling you about the great things about Antonia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I said I'm not going to mention it, but by virtue of saying I'm not going to mention it, I've mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a way of saying I'm not going to do something, but in not saying it, I've actually put the idea in your head. And he's doing that in the lead up to when he says trees are all this poem is about. So in a way, it kind of makes you anticipate him saying things that are not true, or like reading irony into the poem. Because the whole reason that you start to really feel this emotional pull towards these trees and their story is because of him doing that. They did not die from solitude, nor did their branches bear a sterile fruit, nor did their unhealed flanks weep every spring for those 4 yards that lost them everything, as each strained on its shackled root to face the other's empty, intricate embrace. So he's saying this didn't happen, but by saying it, it's making you think it did happen. So then when you get to that last bit, they were trees and trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about, you're already mistrusting the literal reading of the poem.
Oh, he's quite good, isn't he?
He's quite good. Yeah. The thing I find really satisfying about Tom Paterson is you just know that he's thinking on every level, like how do we communicate, with each other? What is actually going on? Because obviously we don't say what we mean, and quite often we don't mean what we say. So there must be other meaning is coming in other places. He has written an entire book on this quite recently, by the way, if anybody wants to go deeper into
What's it called? Two Trees Extended.
it. No, not on this poem. On poetry. It's called The Poem.
Good, solid title.
Yeah, I'm going to give you one line. I trust by now it will be clear that I believe not just poetic meaning, but all meaning to be the consequence of a tropic process or a tropic process.
You want to just translate that word?
So, like, troping literally comes from the word like turning. So, we talk about sunflowers as being heliotropes because they turn towards the sun. So, it comes from the Greek word to turn. And a trope is a kind of commonly misused word, actually, because it's often used to mean like, oh, it's a theme in something. It's a trope in literature for this to happen. But actually, that's not the best. It's got a more exciting meaning than that, which is how we kind of approach meaning from oblique angles. So, like a metaphor is a trope. It's a kind of way that we create meaning, but we don't do it by just going straight at it. We kind of turn, it towards it. You come at it from an arc, in a way. I don't know if that's a helpful way of thinking about it. Metonymy. Got that right?
Yep, that's a word.
It's metonyms. Metonymy. Yeah, which is like when you use, say, for example, one object to which is a part or one part of something to describe the whole. So we talk about the crown, but what we mean is the monarch. The crown is just a part of it. Anyway, that's like a trope of language. So I think he's saying that all meaning works like that. There is no kind of head-on use of language that is literal and descriptive.
That's why we need poetry so much,
Yeah,
because it
exactly.
knows that.
So do you think it's time for some music?
Yes, what are we having today?
Oh, well, I thought we would have Michael Donaghy.
Yes, why Michael Donaghy?
Because the poem that we are reading, Two Trees, is partly about the poet Michael Donaghy, who was also a musician, like Don Paterson himself, who started out in music and then moved into poetry. Michael Donaghy played Irish folk music. So I thought we could listen to Michael Donaghy playing The Maple Leaf, which is an Irish tune.
It's really great, and it does nice close-ups on the YouTube video. You could learn the fingering from it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I think we've both done.
Well, I think you can play it slightly faster. It's nice to see how it's meant to be played.
By Michael Donaghy rather
Yeah.
than.
No, not by you, Kate,
Yeah.
sorry.
I was going to say.
That was Michael Donaghy and The Maple Leaf. Kate, I feel like you have one more thing to say about this poem before we move on.
There's also this other thing going on in this poem. Like another way that you could read it totally differently would be not to think about relationships at all, but to think about two different responses to the natural world around you, and one that's fundamentally creative and one that's fundamentally destructive. And like my scriptural reference for that one would be like the story of the talents. One takes what they're given and then makes more out of it, creates a kind of flourishing and abundance. And the other keeps things just so, is given the one talent and buries it. And in that sense, you've got the first stanza about Don Miguel, and Don Miguel is this person who hasn't who has who's an idealist, has an idea and then pursues that idea. So it doesn't just sort of try and look at the reality around them and take it as it is, but thinks to change it and to transform it and to do it in a way that requires effort and skill. And then the product of it is this flourishing of a tree that brings people joy. Not only does it actually produce fruit after a while, it does say for 12 months from shame or from the fright, they put forth nothing. But one day there appeared two lights in the dark leaves. And then after once that those lights have kind of come through, you get a sense of them being abundant. They get themselves so tangled up that each bough looked like it gave a double crop. So each branch looks like it's got both oranges and lemons in it. And so it's kind of, he's kind of doubled it, what he's been given. And then also you've got the kids getting delight from this. So it's got that extra thing as well. It's not just producing fruit, it's bringing delight. So there's that kind of mentality being explored. And then the second one is someone who has a dark, malicious whim. And also, I like the way he says he'd had no dream. So that's the first contrast. The one, Don Miguel has an idea, the man has no dream. And then he says, who can say what dark, malicious whim led him to take his? So it's like something that we fundamentally can't understand. It's something that doesn't have reason or rationality behind it, that motivates the undoing of that. And also kind of like the undoing of the communion, the kind of the taking of things apart. But he doesn't, it's not like he takes the axe to kill, to destroy them. He just puts them back in their place. He just undoes the work of the person who made things flourish. And then they just continue to live. And everything basically from there to the end of the poem, from where he takes his axe, splits the bole, which is the trunk, along its seam, and then digs two holes. Everything from there to the end is basically in negative form. No, they did not die, nor did their branches, nor did their unhealed flanks. Trees don't weep or ache or shout. And then it's just got that very straightforward final line, trees, and trees are all this poem is about. And in that sense, it's like just two different ways of seeing the world and being in the world that is being presented, the one that dreams and the one that doesn't. But also perhaps you could even push it and say the kind of creative way of being in the world and the kind of positivist literalist way of being in the world.
Possibly, but there's also something funny about it in that both these ways, in some senses, there's a violence that begins either the creativity or the putting back. It's not a sort of gentle act to graft a tree to another tree. It takes him the whole day to work them free, lay open their sides, and lash them tight. It's quite visceral language of pulling them apart, cutting them in half, tying them back together. And then for 12 months, from the shame or from the fright, they put forth nothing. And there's that thing of, well, it may all be in vain. This act is not necessarily creative. There's nothing that says actually this will create something amazing. It's sort of that curiosity, which may be the same curiosity that says, well, I wonder what would happen if I spliced them apart again and then saw whether they lived. There's a kind of human element in nature in both those actions, which is, I wonder what would happen if I did something to this. Like, can I control it, either to bring it together or to return them as they were? So I don't know if it's necessarily a simple here's creation, here's destruction. I think there's a little bit more of the human arbitrariness in both.
Yeah, although I would then just like the one, I do agree with that. And I think they're definitely, you definitely get the sense of there being violence behind both acts, which I wonder if is a sort of way of saying that you basically you can't move in this world without there being violence in what you do. It's kind of part of the nature of the way that we live, like in the fact that you can't act without there being some kind of participation in sin, because there's the sin of the world that's, yeah, that we're kind of living in. But the one thing I would point out, or like to make note of, would be the language difference in the sense that with Don Miguel in the first stanza, the way that he enacts this still has a sense of the gardener's gentleness to it, It's laying, it's like working them free. So he took the whole day to work them free. So just the fact that you've got the idea of like them being free in some sense, and then laying open their sides and lashing, the sounds of the words lay and lash are gentle. He could say cut open their sides, but he doesn't. And whereas when you go to the stanza below, and you the man who had the dark malicious whim, you have the words that have more of a sound of violence in them. So axe and split. The fact that you've got the T and the P, they're like a hard consonants. The P is a plosive. I think it gives you a sense that there's something less caring about it.
I mean, this is where you've got to trust the poet as understanding the motivations of his characters.
I mean, one thing I do know about Don Patterson is that he has been known to rework a poem through about 250 drafts. So I know that he's at least, you can trust him that he's being selective with his language. Grafting, maybe it's time to talk about grafting.
It is. I actually just watched some videos of grafting citrus trees together whilst I was waiting for you. They were very moving. You feel very invested in the tree, you know, as it's being grafted. It's kind of like it probably looks like a wound, and it's really sad watching it sort of wound healing where the grafting's taken place. I don't know, I found it quite moving, probably more moving than I should have, given that it's just two trees. And also amazing that that can actually happen.
Well, I was taught how to graft trees as a teenager as part of an outdoor work sort of GCSE replacement. So it wasn't a GCSE, but it was like the same kind. And part of it was learning how to graft trees.
What a really useful skill. I always think you managed to get some really useful skills in your teenage years.
And like bypassed a lot of really useful ones as well, like, how to like live in the world, like pay tax.
Yeah, but that's an ongoing one, isn't it? You can't nail that as a teenager.
It's true.
But grafting trees, you probably could.
The
Do you think it's worth saying something more about what grafting is and how it works in real life, so that for those who are kind of still wondering what is actually happening here, aside from the poetic language as to whether it's a soft act or a hard act? What is it? And has he actually got it right? Because I feel like his grafting technique isn't exactly right. Or is it possible to literally graft the whole tree to the whole tree? Because I was always under the impression that you took the rootstock from one and sort of grafted to one of the branches rather than to the base, or at least not to the actual bottom.
So I've never heard of a full kind of tree graft, like when you graft all the way down the tree. But then there are lots of different ways of grafting. But you're right. I mean, I wonder if you can undo a graft, actually. I don't know if it's even possible, because you would have to have like separate rootstocks. I think it probably is, though, because trees can naturally graft themselves as well. So sometimes you encounter two trees that, and there is a word for it, I can't remember what it is now, but two trees growing separately in a wood that maybe like have been forced to push against each other for whatever reason, and they might grow into one tree. Or the branch from one tree can grow and into another branch, into another tree. So you get these in kind of arch, these natural arches where a branch has gone from one trunk and then becomes kind of like it's coming out of both of them. So maybe it is possible to have two separate rootstocks and a grafted tree. But you're right, generally speaking, you would either graft a branch onto another trunk. So you might take like the lemon rootstock and then put the orange onto it. Or you would, so sometimes you can get a completely separate rootstock altogether, and then put the two species that you want to grow as the branches onto this individual rootstock. So it's kind of like three things grafted together.
Why would you do that?
Because certain species will have a hardier rootstock. So like, say for example, with apple, I can't think of anything specific because it's now like 15 years ago since I actually learned any of this. But you might have a certain kind of like, apple, let's just say it's Braeburn, which has a rootstock that you know will survive the winter or is is better, is like more reliable at, I don't know, supplying nutrients from the earth, or the root system is better, or whatever it is. So you would take that in its first year of growth and then put two like little new growth branches into the top on either side of two different, like say you want russets and pink ladies. Then you'd put those two on top of the Braeburn rootstock. Don't take those. That combination may be a nonsense. I don't know. I can't remember. But I know that there's definite times when you would take that first year of growth and then put two different things grafted onto the top. And actually, you can do more than two. You can do five. But you
Just
just.
becomes a bit chaotic after a while, though, doesn't it?
But basically, you're just using one system to feed the others. They're almost like sort of parasites growing off it.
And is that about right that it might take about 12 months for them to settle, or is it usually a bit faster or slower?
I can't remember. I think it sounds right to me, but I mean, to go through the seasons and then for them to come to fruit the following season, that sounds plausible.
What time of year does one do grafting?
You want it when there's new growth.
You probably want it before it started really, really going off, though, wouldn't you? So that it took the grafted shoot with it. So it's more like earlier spring than late spring.
Yeah, you're right, early spring, yeah. Yeah, so that it's got all that sort of power of and energy for new growth.
And so on that piece of delightfully nebulous advice about grafting, we suggest you go and look it up for yourselves. And maybe you're not too late to try and graft an orange tree to a lemon tree this season, although you may have to wait a little while for the fruit. It's been great talking to you, Kate. I think that's us for today. Join us again next time, where we are going to be talking about Louise Glick. So it's not one to miss. It's going to be exciting. Goodbye.
I'm sitting on the balcony reading Flannery O'Connor with a pencil and a pen. This song is like a rain cloud that keeps circling overhead. And there it comes around again.
This was a Radio Maria podcast. If you enjoyed it, do please click like and subscribe on your podcast provider or leave us a review. Every bit of feedback helps increase our visibility and allows us to reach more people with the message of Christ's saving truth. And if you don't already, you can listen to Radio Maria live either online or on DAB in selected regions of the UK. We'd love for you to call in live and be part of the conversation. See our website, radiomariaengland.uk, for more details and a full schedule of programmes. And do please consider making a donation so that we can keep making more programmes like this. We are completely dependent upon the generosity of our listeners.